this is the Angry GM, and this is the Q&A portion following the proofread aloud of the article I just finished proofreading aloud, which is Fumble Beats Crit, where I will now take questions and respond to comments from the audience who listened to me record the whole thing. So I am just waiting for some questions to come in, and it looks like we already have a question from Athator in... I don't know. Yeah. But that's the old thing, right? Like, I don't know why I did that, but that's like the old, like, you were reading a... Athator in Gary, Indiana asks... like, I don't know why I just suddenly slipped that in. Athator in... Athator, the villain from Axiom Verb asks... Axiom Verge, not Axiom Verb. Oh, I'm a mess today. I've blown a minute now. So Athator asks, how important is it that the players explicitly know about the fail by five rule prior to me introducing it? Is it something they can discover through play, or do they need to know which checks have this rule and which checks don't? Okay, so keep in mind, one of the arguments I stated is that the existence of the fail by five rule creates a sense of ratcheting tension inside the player's brains. And that should give you all the answer you need. If the players do not know about it, they will not benefit from the pants-shitting terror of it existing. So yes, they must know about it, and they must... So yeah, that's it. So Minstrel, the many-eyed beholder bard, asks, with the many-eyed, like the beholder, the one, as opposed to the one-eyed beholder, like the cyclopean beholder. Will you expand on how 5e passives are not an effective replacement for 3.5's take 10? So glad you asked. Yes, I will. And also, no, I won't. Okay, because, so part of it, okay, so here's the technical answer. The technical answer is this. Take 10 is something you do on an action. That is, when you must make an action check, and the situation is not stressful, you're not being chased by monsters, or the room isn't filling with lava, or anything else that just provides this essential feeling of stress, you, the player, may elect not to roll the dice, but instead just assume you rolled a 10. In world, what this means is your character is just taking their time a little bit. They're calmly trying to get through the situation without worrying, how hard it is. They could just stay focused. You know, it's the benefit of not being stressed. Okay. What that means is that they can just say, I'm just going to take the average result, whatever it is. They can do this on almost any action. There are certain actions that do not allow it. But for the most part, it does not reflect just this passive awareness of the world. It does not reflect things that aren't actions. It is instead a choice the character makes about how to approach the situation in front of them. Now, that may seem like the same thing effectively. It's still just a passive check, right? It's still just, you got a 10 on the die roll, you add your modifier, and that's compared to the DC. But the importance, first of all, is that it is all action-based. There is nothing passive in D&D 3.5. And if there is something passive, you just don't roll it, or the GM calls for the, like, spot and listen, I realize, are essentially passive activities. And the GM has to then call for those rolls, or more normally, the GM rolls them behind the screen. And then in those cases, by the way, the players don't have the option to take 10 because it's just this passive, like, it's this momentary passive thing. It's not like you're actually searching the world around you. It's your awareness. And honestly, that could be improved greatly in D&D 3.5. Then again, D&D has never handled awareness well. However, the key difference is it is a choice the player makes, reflected in a choice the character makes to just you know, take their time a little bit, go slow because they're not stressed. It is still essentially a way to resolve an action, and it's at the player's option. The fact of the matter is these little bits and pieces change how it feels at the table. And as I've just explained, how things feel at the table are everything. Okay, this isn't about what you can reduce and theorize by reading the rules and doing the math. This is about the way people behave when they are operating under these rules. And if you watch the way players behave, as I've been doing and as I used to do, you can see the differences. I've even seen the differences in my own behavior, just in the difference in the way I've been putting together my own game. And that's also what this article is about. It's about watching how people behave under the rules. So Wiley asks, what are some scenarios where you have had the most success with Fail by Five? As I said in the article, the most successful uses of it are in situations where incremental progress makes sense in the game world and where there is some sort, where you can create this sort of logical idea of the difference between no progress versus disaster. I used climbing in the article because it is the single best example that I can come up with. Because the idea is climbing is an incremental process. You make progress one little check at a time, and then occasionally there is a chance that a disaster will befall you. So is balancing. So is disarming traps. You can make an argument that it would work very, very well in social situations where, a failure by less than five would not convince the person, but also not dissuade them, and a failure by five or more actively turns the person against you in some way. You know, so anything like, honestly, the fail by five thing is a much better implementation of the shit implementation of skill challenges that they tried to cram into 4E. They work so much better than that, you know? And I mean, that's part of the key too, is like, you can't just build a skill challenge from 4E. And I see Minstrel just ask a question. Isn't this just 4E skill challenges? If not, how do you distinguish the two? Well, first of all, it's not, because the rules are utterly different. Okay? Secondly, one of the keys is that it is not, you do not build a skill challenge in 3.5. You apply the rules, and the rules are designed carefully so that situations that would be skill challenges are skill challenges without you having to know what a skill challenge is and design one. Okay. Again, I do not have to do anything special to get a climbing skill challenge that works very effectively at the table. I just have to put a cliff there and screw with the players however I want with that cliff after that. You know, have them do the cliff during combat or put poison. I think two sessions ago, there was like poisonous brambles lining the base of this cliff. And the party decided, oh, hell no, we're just going to go try and find another way up. And then they walked like an hour out of their way. So to punish them for walking an hour out of their way in the forest, I dropped like spiders on them or some shit like that. Because that'll teach them not to engage with my cliff. But yeah, they are not effectively skill challenges. And the key is, again, in how GMs interact with this. Okay, so when you want to design a skill challenge in 4E or a complex encounter in 5E because it doesn't even have the framework of skill challenges, what do you have to do as a GM? First, you have to come up with the situation. Then you have to define a bunch of actions and say the players could do this, this, and this to progress. Then you have to come up with a way to measure success and failure, right? So you need a whatever stat, or you need this, or you need that. And then you need to come up with the consequences for this, 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 and that. And then you need to build all this shit. And by the time you're done, you have built something that is so friggin' abstract and artificial It has nothing to do with the situation. At no point does it feel like you're disarming a bomb or having a social challenge. Okay? By creating a set of rules that inherently add ratcheting tension, some of the time, not all of the time, but some of the time, and creating a set of rules that allow the players and the GM to opt out of unnecessary die rolls whenever the die rolls are apparently unnecessary, because there's also the take 20 rule, then you have a situation where the GM never has to climb up to that abstract level and say, okay, I want to make a climbing mini game. How would I do that? And end up with something that isn't climbing. You know, I watch my players handle the climbing challenges and the other challenges of this type in my game. And what they're doing is the stuff that we used to do back in the old days. They're sitting there and considering the cliff and saying, okay, who can we send up there? Someone's going to have to get up there and tie off a rope, and then the rest of us can follow. And there's always like something like, well, can we do boosties? Can somebody give somebody a boost? Maybe I'll take my armor off. I'm really strong. I'm not the best climber, but I'm stronger than you. So maybe I'll strip my armor off. You can tie it to a rope and hoist it up. And then all of a sudden what the party is doing is actually like climbing a cliff. Okay, they're not. They're not like playing a mini game. They're not rolling dice as you call for rolls. They're sitting there saying, okay, we need to move up this vertical surface. How do we do that and minimize the chance one of us is going to die? You know, and that's the beauty of it. Okay. The more you need these abstract mechanics to model a situation, the more you make a GM think about the mechanics instead of just saying, and now there's a cliff here, the more chance you have that you're just going to pull the players out of the game and ask them to play Yahtzee. Okay. Wes Balmont. I ran a skill challenge in my last Pathfinder 2 game just by describing four simultaneous problems and asked what the players want to do in response. I didn't track anything except the fiction, felt like a skill challenge, but was just 10 words in my prep. Bingo bazinga exactly. Okay. 99 times out of 10, there's an article I'm supposed to write this month, and I'm pushing it off because I don't know how to write it, because basically it is the article you just wrote, Wes Balmont. Okay, and that is this. Do you want to know how to build any type of encounter in your game? Just do it like this. Describe the fucking encounter and ask the players what they do and resolve it. The end. That's how you do it. The minute you start dicking around with weird mechanics, you've ruined your game. You have. You've just ruined it. The game doesn't need extra mechanics, doesn't need mini games. Mini games suck. And the only reason we keep adding mini games is because the rules in the books are so damn insufficient for the shit we're actually trying to do. I am stood up now and passionately yelling about this. I just want this clear. You are not getting a Q&A anymore. This is just a rant on all of the failings of modern gaming. This is how D&D and Pathfinder and everything else in the last 20 years have failed GMs. Because I have to now be a master of game design and know how to build game mechanics just to get my players from the bottom to the top of a cliff in an exciting way. And that's why I have to sit here every other week and field questions like, well, how can I build a good challenge about climbing up a cliff? Because I literally get that question all the time. I'll say something like, and then in my game, I drop the cliff that the players have to climb. And then all of a sudden, it's 10 questions into my email. Like, well, how would you build that challenge? It's like, I didn't. I described a cliff. I didn't build a challenge. How did you handle it with this camp with all these people who, you know, the players had to befriend them? It's like, I don't even know. They just showed up and started talking, and then I started talking. We talked back and forth, and every so often I would roll dice because dice rolls were needed, and then I decided, okay, now you're friends. Okay. Anyway. So, Minstrel, the point is, the fail by five encounters are not encounters. They're rules that apply to certain action resolution mechanics. And as such, because the action resolution mechanics provide much more depth of outcome and tension, then the GM doesn't have to intentionally try to build extended challenges based on them. Instead, the rules are giving them the tools they need so that if they just put together elements of the world, an exciting, intense challenge will fall out naturally through gameplay. And Wes Belmont, your skill challenge sounds exactly like the way I make my games. And that sounds like a really great situation. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Huh. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Jack the Red Creeper is asking, does Pathfinder 2E style of making characters look for critical successes through modifier stacking reduce the importance of said critical successes? First of all, critical successes do not matter. Critical successes, as I argued in my article, actually I didn't argue, I just asserted. Critical successes are shit. You don't need them in your game. They're garbage. Take them out. Critics have no place in the game anymore. Second, I don't know. I don't run Pathfinder 2E. I haven't read the rule book. I haven't bothered. So I can't say for sure. Sorry. I'm going to respond to a comment that wasn't made in the Q&A thread, but nonetheless, it deserves a response because it is, again, exactly what I said in the article. So Jack the Red Creeper said, I personally hate how getting critted by an enemy feels like the dice saying, ha ha, now you die. Yes. Yes. That's exactly why if anybody can roll crits, enemies can. And that's also why you don't design games based on what players like and dislike, because players like and dislike the wrong things and they'll ruin games if you let them design them. So Proselys is asking about monster crits. Okay, so here's the thing for those of you listening to the recording. I pause the recording when I don't have questions or comments, but I still try to fill the dead air by babbling incessantly. For the people who are listening live. And then occasionally I end up babbling at something that's actually useful. And then somebody will ask a question or comment based on the context of my incessant babbling. But I don't want to record a bunch of dead air. So here we are. So this is why Proselys is asking about crits for monsters. Because I was just babbling. I was basically teasing the live listeners by saying, I'm not going to tell you all why I said the things I said about crits. But Proselys is trying to get me to talk about crits here. I'm sad that nobody is asking me about the historical context for crits and why crits were actually invented by the Germans in the 1830s. But then again, a very simple search can turn that up too. It's well known, or at least it's reasonably known. Anyway, Proselys asks, so crits for monsters are the most important for adding crit successes. Do you like the monsters to just do more damage, or do you think it's better if they do something else? I think it's always better if there's something more interesting than just bigger numbers. But I will also say that's like a dangerous route to go down. Because the more, like, here's the thing. Okay. If the effect of a critical hit is just double damage, that's very easy for a GM to adjudicate, and descriptive GMs can describe it, and non-descriptive gamey GMs who aren't good at describing things can just throw that into the game, and it works perfectly well for everybody. The more pressure you put on a GM to be creative, okay, the more barriers you're putting to running your game, the more expertise you're requiring. So, okay, fine. The next step up from critical damage is every monster could have a certain crit effect, right? Like, and when the toad monster crits, it swallows someone, or this and that and the other thing. Okay, there's problems with that approach, especially when you get into strategic and tactical play should never be based on randomness, which is why the age system sucks. And, you know, there is a danger that if you start designing monsters that way, you're going to bury their strategies behind crits. Whereas a toad just 90% of the time is just ramming people. And 1% of the time it gets to use its swallow hole ability. So you don't like, you don't want to give, like, you only have control over this ability at random. So you don't want to do that. So then the next step up is you have critical tables, right? Roll on this table and some random critical hit will happen. Now you run into the problem where you're going to have some nonsensical interactions. Like, it's bludgeoning damage against an arm. It's a broken arm, right? But then you have some weird situation. Like, it's bludgeoning damage, but it's done, by a toad, like, body checking you. I can't even think of a good example of a weird corner case, but that's why they're weird corner cases. They're hard to think of. But you're always going to end up running into that scenario where it's like, okay, yeah, the decapitate by dagger thing. I've done piercing damage with a very small weapon, and now, but somehow I have stabbed a dragon through the heart, right? Something like that. Yeah, it just doesn't work. Okay, so now you need the GM to be aware of those things, and then the GM has to either re-roll or has to start being creative. And now again, you're starting to require this level of creativity on the GM that is going to be a barrier to certain GMs, and you don't really want to do that too much. In fact, the whole thesis of this article was basically the only reason I had to write the articles that made me famous and started my career as the angry GM is because 4E and 5E had categorically shittier core action resolution than D&D 3.5 did, consequently requiring someone to come in and teach GMs to be experts at action resolution when you never had to be before. Okay, anyway, so I like when crits do more than just damage, okay? But from a design standpoint, that may not be the best solution. It's got to be implemented very carefully. Okay. Dire Wear Teddy. What additional skills do you apply the fail by five results to? Okay. I do apply it to knowledge skills where there is a situation where the player could be lied to, could have false knowledge. I think I just got a 5-minute warning. Okay. Where the players could end up with false knowledge, right? So, and those are roles where I'm making in secret. So, for example, appraise checks and knowledge checks are the big ones. I will roll behind the screen, and if the player's check fails by five or more, I will give them intentionally false information. I don't advise that as a general approach because it falls into the category of demanding the GM be creative again. And I don't think that's a great thing to do. But for my personal games, when I can always come up with false information that is based on truth, it's like, yeah, you misread something on demons, and you know they're all good aligned apparently according to what you read. Like, it's nothing that ridiculous, but like misappraisals and misknowledges are really good examples of that. And I think I have used them in social situations. And then there's also, and this is the most important thing, I keep the mechanic in my pocket so that when I see a situation where it does make sense in the game to suddenly have the fail by five, I will use it and say something like, okay, so you can go ahead and try to disarm that trap, and you know, it's on a hair trigger. So just know, if you fail on the roll, you can try again and you keep trying to disarm it. But if you fail by five or more, it's gonna blow up in your face and kill everyone around you. So that the players know what's at stake, or at least as much as the characters would know. Okay. Is the release of tension due to a player crit not particularly valuable? No, it's not particularly valuable. If it were valuable, I wouldn't have said crits that players can make is totally valuable, which I didn't say. I said crits. Players making crits is useless. It can be taken from the game and it would change nothing. Nothing of value would be lost. Okay, Jack the Red Creeper. That scene of the players looking at the cliff they want to scale and determining what they can do, would that be an example of avoiding push-button play? Yes. Proselyst, decapitate by dagger. Okay, October Foundry. Why were crits invented in Germany in the 1800s? Because my people, the Germans, are badasses, okay? So, okay, but really... It's actually Prussia. It's the Prussian states pre-unification. But here's the deal. Wargaming The Prussians had a wargaming tradition, actual tabletop wargaming. They used it to teach strategy. They were called Kriegsspiel, which my pronunciation is terrible, but Kriegsspiel, which literally just means war game. And they would set up tables with sand on it that was molded into terrain, work out battles and things like that. One developer of one Prussian Kriegsspiel, back in the day, just before he died, I think, he came up with the idea that there needed to be a way to reflect the sort of surprises that would sometimes come up on the battlefield, where just the perfect alignment of completely unpredictable situations beyond anyone's control would result in things just working way too well or way too badly. You know, like you just have, you know, just the right combination of things, and then suddenly a unit routes where it, you know, by math, you would have guessed it would have been an ordered retreat. I know I'm running out of time now. And I'm desperately trying to avoid asking for 5 more minutes. So this is going to have to be the last question. Okay. So, you know, the idea was to add this concept of the unpredictable super situation, because otherwise the resolution is just a little bit too mechanical and it only leads to predictable results. And one of the things you need to learn to deal with in terms of strategy is the fact that sometimes for things that you totally couldn't foresee or map out, everything's going to go to shit or everything is going to go wonderful. Okay? Far beyond what the dice would say. And that's honestly why crits ended up in actually ended up being so popular in computer role-playing games. Because the actual path of crits was, they were added to this obscure tabletop role-playing game, Empire of the Petal Throne, which was eventually bought and republished by TSR. But it was really in video games where crits gained their popularity. And that was precisely because, I really have to wrap this up because I'm now out of time. Okay, so let me finish this thought. So precisely because as a player, you kind of get used to the mechanical rhythm. Like, you know that on a, you know, the monster does 8 damage, monster does 6 damage, monster does 7 damage, monster does 4 damage, or whatever. So within a narrow range, the monster's random damage is just doing this much damage each round, and you're doing just this much damage each round. Okay, and then the problem is even that becomes predictable. So you add these situations where once in a while, holy shit, you know, the damage wasn't just 4 or 5 or 3 or whatever and all in that narrow range, suddenly it's 12, okay? So if you're sitting there and being a good mechanical, mathematical player and saying, well, my hit points are above 8, which means I could take 2 more hits. My hit points are above 9, which means I could take 2 more hits, whatever it is, and using that to gauge your tactics, then it's all very mechanical, and there is never a risk that you're suddenly going to be surprised with something that's going to drive you down to dead or drive you down to near dead. And that the existence of that then takes away your mechanical ability to just gauge your hit points round to round and optimize all the tension out of it, because you never know when this random crit is going to happen. And that is why it is valuable to have crits in combat, and why they are much more important when they can be done against the players. And that is my final thought. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Procellus, for the extra minute. I will see you all next week.